Well, good evening, everyone. This is Pam Stack. I'm your host for Authors on the Air. I hope you're all well and have enjoyed your week. I'm delighted to be back. My guest tonight is Susan Shea. She is used to be an executive with a nonprofit organization for 20 years, which I really appreciate because I've done nonprofit work myself. And I'm thrilled that that she's coming on. We're just having a hard time connecting. I think that she's late coming in from a movie, which is funny because I can't wait to ask her about it. It's one I want to see. And anyway, along the way, she picked up some good stories. So in 2006, she took a break from doing her executive work and decided to write fiction full-time, which I love that. She has two mystery series. One is the Danny O'Rourke Mysteries and is debuting from St. Martin Minotaur in May 2017, a French Village Mystery Series, which I think is magnificent. I cannot wait to talk to her. But in the meantime, until she comes on the line, and I'm waiting for her to call me right now, Susan, where are you? Call me now. I'm sure she's trying to get through. I want to let you know that on Friday, I'm going to be speaking to my friend Revis Wilson, who does the Red River Mystery Series. So his new book, Unraveled, is what we're going to be talking about on Friday. In the meantime, it's my pleasure to welcome to Authors on the Air for the first time, Susan C. Shea. Hello, darling. How are you tonight?
Hi.
Rushing around like a crazy lady, right? You were
right.
I know you're at a movie, and so I'm assuming that you kind of got hung up there. But tell me, did you end up seeing Doctor Strange?
I certainly did.
Let's hear your review. Oh, good. Yes,
I really liked it. You can only have so many fight scenes before it begins to get repetitive. But I will say this. Benedict Cumberbatch took off his shirt at one point, and he is really buff. You wouldn't think that with all those brains, you know, but there, he also has the physique to go with all those fans of his.
Oh, well, that's good. I'm sure you've heard me say that I don't own a television, and also that I very rarely go to movies. It's probably been 10 years. But lately, there have been a lot of films that are very interesting to me because I like the fantasy genre. So I like the idea. I want to try to find them. I don't even know where the movie theater is near me. But I want to see that one, and I want to see The Amazing Beasts, and I want to see, you know, there are a few, and the Star Wars movie when that comes out, although I understand tickets are sold out for a while. But you see, the trick is I'll go when the kids are in school.
Well,
but
let me tell you about a movie that I'm raving about to everyone. It's called Moonlight. It's called Moonlight, and it just won won major awards in New York at the Gotham Festival. It's really extraordinary, and as a writer, I love it because the writer and the director start out with a character who speaks very little. He's so, as a child and as an adolescent and as an adult, he is so unable to express his feelings that all these actors and all these scenes have to be played with this incredible sense of tension from what he can't say. And it's beautifully done.
It shows him in three different stages of his life. Like,
yes,
as
it
you
does.
Right.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, it's just beautiful. And some people have said, oh, but I'm sure it's very depressing because it's about a poor black boy growing up in bad neighborhoods and in bad family in Miami. But actually, it's about hope and it's about love. And at the end, I didn't feel depressed at all. I just felt this wonderful sense of love conquers everything.
Oh, I'm so glad. Well, I'm originally from Miami, so I guess I should do. I wonder if they filmed it there. I should go and watch that movie and find out. Oh,
yeah,
they did. Okay. So
yeah.
I'll recognize.
So that's the one I'm telling all my friends they must see.
Oh, how wonderful. I'm so glad. So let's talk about you. I was saying as I was introducing you that I've been involved in nonprofits myself. I was an executive director for quite a few different nonprofits.
Uh-huh.
And it's a very rewarding job to have. Tell me about the type of nonprofit that you worked for.
Well, I also have worked for a number of them. I started working for colleges, and I really did enjoy that. I worked for several colleges and universities, and then I started my own consulting practice in strategic communications and fundraising, and that's kind of what I do and the wrapping around my Danny O'Rourke mysteries. And then I worked for a really world-known, famous science organization. I was the ED of the Institute of Human Origins, which was founded by the scientist who discovered Lucy in Ethiopia. And that was a real treat. Yeah, it was a real treat because I knew a little bit about it before I joined, but I was in the situation of having the executive office next to the founders, so if there was something I didn't understand about any aspect of human origins, I could just walk next door and ask Don Johansson, which was, you know, quite a treat.
I imagine. Wow, that I can imagine was a really big experience. So you've done a variety of things that you said have contributed to your imagination, and when you decided to do your dream job of writing fiction, you had some story ideas already lined up. Tell me about that. How was the transformation made? Had you always been a writer? Give us a little background so we can go on and talk about your books too.
Okay. Well, I like a lot of writers, when people ask at a conference and they ask a writer or at a reading, they say, you know, when did you know you wanted to be a writer? And almost all of us say by the third grade. It's one of those things. It's more than a skill. It's a real passion and a predilection.
Sure.
Yeah. And so I've always wanted to be a writer, and all the work that I've done, I was a journalist, and then I worked in college public relations, and then I went on to do the fundraising. But I did a lot of writing all the way along for all of that. Problem was by about 2005, I had decided I really wanted to write a mystery. And I won't bother you with the backstory on that, but there was something that propelled me into it. But I was still working. I was the director of a large aspect of Santa Clara University's operations, and that included writing for the president. I wrote his annual reports. I wrote his president's report.
Oh,
I wrote a lot of his speeches.
Wow.
And then I would go home at night, and I would be trying to write like a 35-year-old divorced woman, but he was a 70-year-old Jesuit priest. And I was having a hard time making the mental switch from one voice to another. And so my partner, who was an artist, said to me, you know, you really owe it to yourself to quit your day job and write. And I panicked about money like a lot of writers do. How am I ever going to make do? And he gave me some good advice about deciding when I had enough money to do it so that I wouldn't panic. And so I made up my mind, and I saved my pennies and did it. And, you know, then I finished the first book.
Is that the Danny O'Rourke series came first?
That was the first, the first in the Danny O'Rourke series. And, you know, I was beginning to shop it to agents when Tim, my partner, got sick. And I was I was glad that I wasn't working because I could be with him all the time. But shortly after he died, a week before he died, he said to me, "Oh, Susan, you have to get an agent before I die." And I said, "Oh, Tim, it's really hard. You have no idea. It's such a hard thing to do. And then a couple months later, I had already signed up for the Book Passage Mystery Writers Conference in Corte Madera, California. And I went to it and showed my work to an agent who signed me on the spot. And I've always had the feeling that there was a little divine intervention there somewhere because it was a little easier than it is for most of my friends.
Wow. What a story. I'm sorry about the loss of your partner, and I'm sure he was thrilled to hear that you found an agent. It just worked out for you, and that's great. Tell us about your first book. You have all the time in the world. Pretend like you're at the tall building and you're going all the way down to the bottom, but in a slow elevator. So you don't have to rush it. But I want to talk about your books, and then we'll talk about some other things too.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have been interested in art all my life. I grew up in the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York, and I just love art, and it's part of my life. But what I have had begun to notice in following art is the growing importance of the marketplace and the auction houses, and what was beginning to be sort of obscene prices being paid for works of art. And I couldn't quite figure out where the money was coming from. And so I got more and more interested and did more research about the inflated prices of art. You know, in the last couple of years, someone paid $300 million for a Gauguin painting, $250 million for a Cezanne, $142 million for a Francis Bacon painting, and it goes on and on and on. And you have to begin to wonder, because what had been happening in the market was that art was turning from something beautiful, passionate, challenging, whatever, into an investment and into a way to, I realized, hide money. So people were spending money on art, but not for art's sake. That inspired me to think about art plus money equals crime, which is my mantra. You know, when there's too much money floating around in the art market, there's just too much of a temptation, of all different kinds of temptations, from money laundering, of drug money, and ways to hide money that you don't really want to report on your income tax. And then there's the thefts for museum, and smuggled artifacts and fakes. And, you know, there's just a huge amount of ability to manipulate the art market by throwing money at it. And that became the source of all three of the Danny mysteries. Each one takes on a different aspect of that. The first one is called Murder in the Abstract, and it tells the story of a young artist who hits the big time suddenly, only to be killed before he can savor the fruits of success. And so the question is, what happens? Here is now an artist who's just beginning to make big money on his art, and he's dead. So now the value of the art goes up, doesn't it? Because there's no more.
It sure does, every time, doesn't it?
Yep, yep. Interesting. And in the second one, The King's Jar, I focused on a precious artifact that had been found in Africa and that was owned not by the Africans, and even though it was made in China, not by the Chinese, but by a billionaire who was prepared to give it to a museum, but its provenance was tainted, and he didn't want people to find that out. So it was about power and ego and status all wrapped up in a piece of art.
I think art is like that, isn't it? I mean, art is really like that. It is so much about, I mean, I hear that these people who buy these very expensive pieces, you know, sometimes just put them in little closets, air-conditioned closets, to look at them.
In vaults. They put them in vaults in Switzerland.
In vaults. Yeah. And then, you know, once a year go and look at them, it doesn't make any sense to me. I don't know if you recall, I think it was last year, someone was claimed that they found a train in either Poland or Lithuania or something. It was supposed to be a train that had been buried after the war of paintings that the Nazis, do you recall that story, that the Nazis had stolen?
I remember that story, but there are always stories like that. That's a great way, if you want to introduce fake art and create a provenance for it that's very hard for people to figure out. Is you have this story that from the frenetic and chaotic times during the Nazi occupation of Poland and France and Belgium, where people's artwork was stolen and transported all over Europe. And so it has made it very difficult to actually know what's real and what's not. And who owns it?
It was very interesting. And, of course, the two guys who claimed they knew the location, you know, never came forward. It was just a big hoax. Mm-hmm. But I think that happens every so often. You're going to find someone who, you know, and apparently there were plenty of trains loaded with
yes.
stolen goods. And who the heck
yes.
knows where they are, you know, where they've ended up. I don't think we'll ever know where everything is. But art is an interesting thing.
Well, did you hear the story? In 2012, there was a robbery in Rotterdam, and a whole bunch of really significant paintings were stolen. There were works by Matisse and Monet and Picasso, and they were very valuable. And then they caught the ringleaders, and they sentenced them to jail, but the ringleaders would never say where the paintings were. And the best guess they have is that the mother of the ringleader may have burned the paintings as a way to protect her son.
It's like burning a book. It hurts me to hear things
like
that. I cannot imagine. I cannot imagine. Oh, my God, how awful. It's just mind-boggling. To protect the kid who went to jail anyway, right? The son who
right.
went to jail.
That's right. Jeez, and he went to jail anyway.
Incredible. Oh, goodness gracious. Susan, it's very interesting to me that you since 2006, you've got three books out, and you're going to be working with Minotaur. Congratulations on that.
Thank you.
I think that's spectacular. Tell me a little bit about your process, because each author I talk to, and I've done 1,000 author interviews over the past 5 years, mm-hmm. and everybody has something unique about the way they sit down to write. What makes you unique in your process?
I can't claim to be unique, really. I suppose maybe I'm one of the worst people at procrastinating. I want to write every day, and I do write every day, and then something comes up. I have friends and family, and I have chores and things like that, and I'll miss a day. And if I miss one day, it's easier to miss the second day. And if I miss the second day, I may very well miss the third day. So I suppose my uniqueness is in my inability to maintain a discipline unless I write every day. So I finished writing about an hour ago for the day. I know that my weakness is if I don't do it, it's easier not to do it the next day. So,
Do you have a dedicated writing space in your home?
I do, finally. Yes, I moved a few years ago, and I have a wonderful room. It's all for writing, and I have my back to the books by all these wonderful authors that just jam the shelves from the floor to the ceiling mm-hmm. and from one wall to the other, because in my other house, I used to look at them, and that was pretty intimidating. So now I turn my
yes.
back on them when I work.
So funny. That's so funny. But listen, I'm no one to talk. I have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 piles of books on the floor that go up to my ceiling. And,
well, you read like 400 books a year. How do you do that?
Yeah. Well, first of all, not all books are 500 pages, as you well know. Mm-hmm. I include novellas in that. So I'm a speed reader, and I have learned how to read books fast. If I read, I have my favorite authors. I have my 100 favorite authors who I'm always
mm-hmm.
going to read their books.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
knowing their writing style and who their characters are helps. But there are some books that I will be honest, I'll stop and I read out loud because the prose is so beautiful. And I just, it's necessary for me to do that. I don't have a television.
Wow.
And I live by myself with cats. I'm one
uh-huh.
of those women that, you know, will probably be spoken about as the crazy cat lady after I'm gone. But, you know, my house is just filled with books. I go out.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm not a shut-in or anything, but
I know. I've met you at the conventions.
Right, Right. So, but I don't know. I just do. It's my joy. It's my joy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't go to work. I go to play. This I have the best job in the world.
Yeah. That's what I feel about my work, too.
Yeah.
That it is really, after all the years of working, you know, in solving other people's problems, I have to solve my character's problems. And that may not be easier, but it's more fun.
As a writer now, you've shifted out of writing for the 70-year-old, and now you've shifted into your own space as an author. Do you have stories floating in your head all the time? Or do you have to be inspired by something? You have stories all the time?
All the time.
You have
my goodness.
Really?
Do you have
characters too?
Yes. As a matter of fact, I was waiting to find out if the French series would sell, I dashed off a caper.
You're fading a little bit. I'm not sure if you're moving around or what, so I'm going to. All right,
I'm not moving.
So go ahead. We'll wing it. We're fine.
Okay. I wrote a caper mystery sort of as a lark. It needs work, but there's always a story. There's a story every day that I think would be interesting if I only had the ambition and the energy to write it.
I love caper stories, so I hope you do write it. I really do. I hope that you write it and put it out into the world, because those are almost one of my favorite books to read.
They are fun. Yeah, they really are fun. And it's about art, of course. So it's about people trying to scam people who turn out to be trying to scam other people. And, you know how capers go wrong.
I love those. I love those stories. Those are the best stories. And not everyone can pull off a caper story. Not everyone can do it. It's easy to unravel if someone is not a talented writer. So I'm really looking forward to seeing that book in print one day. I hope you go through with it.
Well, thanks.
You have all of these things in your head, these stories floating around. I'm sure you could probably just think up stories just from life in general. Do you also get outside influences? Are you do you watch people and say, they're an interesting looking couple. I can almost imagine them, da 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 da, whatever it happens to be. Or do all these things come internally from you?
Well, I think when I do, I'm like a lot of writers you've talked to have said the same thing, I'm sure. And that is that I look at people and I eavesdrop on conversations. I don't always build the story around them, but I'm dreadful that way. I have a little notebook, a little leather notebook that I carry with me everywhere. And if I see a gesture even or a way I can see people in a doorway and I can tell they're having an argument, and I try to write down, how was I able to tell that they're having an argument just by looking at them? So I do a lot of that, but I don't take that as the whole story. The most I've ever done, the inspiration for the first French mystery, and for all of them really, for the two characters, are two friends of mine who did, in fact, what my characters do. They threw everything up in the United States, and they moved to France. And they thought it was going to be easy. And they moved to a little town in France, and there turned out to be lots of reasons why it wasn't easy, although it's been a real adventure. And they are the inspirations. Alice and David are their names for the characters Catherine and Michael in Love and Death in Burgundy. And I have openly acknowledged that and dedicated the book to them.
Lovely.
And written about them. And that's the only time.
Did they see Under the Tuscan Sun too many times? Is that what happened?
Well, this is a little bit like, it's sort of a combination of that and, a little bit of a Jane Austen book, because people in a small enclosed society like this tiny village in France where they live need to have certain kind of social conventions, and they need to get along. And when something goes awry in Jane Austen's world, even if it's a very small thing, the world is not right until people come to terms with it and get their society back in shape. And that was really the story idea that came from visiting them in their little town in France. So, yes, in that case, yes, but usually not.
How lovely. How lovely. How do you
and it's
know
funny.
Which stories you're gonna pluck out and start to work on?
The ones that won't
What's
leave me alone.
Really?
There are just some that won't leave me alone. They're either once they get in my head, they sort of flesh themselves out in my head, and then then I'm excited to start writing it down.
How fun. Hang on just one half a second while I let everybody know. If you want to call in and say hi to Susan, the number is 347-633-9609. This is a copyrighted podcast solely owned by the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network, LLC. Okay, we've got business done. I want to ask you, when you decide you're going to sit down and write, I think it's so funny that you admit that you're – when you're sitting down and writing – are you okay then? You're fine, you're not procrastinating, you're in a zone and you're just going along. Is that right? Or is
well,
it
that's
trouble
the
for you?
That's the best days. Yeah, when it goes like that, I'm thrilled. And it does happen. And sometimes I'll write 2,000 or 3,000 words and be really sorry that I have to get up and feed the cats because I'm a cat lady too.
Love it.
But sometimes it's just like swimming in molasses. I mean, I know where I need to go, and I just cannot figure out how to write 500 words to get there. It's really, I know other writers have the same problems. There are times
sure.
when you're in the zone, and there are times when you cannot find that zone for love or money.
Boy, that must be frustrating. I kind of understand where you're coming from. I really do. It's kind of like my frustration when I want someone to come on the show so bad, and I'm waiting and waiting and waiting for an answer. So that's my frustration
right.
with it. But interesting to me, do you outline or storyboard, or do you sit down and write as you see it in your head?
Well, for the first couple of books, I simply wrote. I was what's called a pantser. I just write by the seat of my pants. I felt really confident, foolishly so, but I felt very confident. And that meant that when I was finished, I had something that had the bones of a good story, but it needed a whole lot of rewriting. I got a little tired of that with the third Danny book, which is called Mixed Up with Murder, and which just came out in February. I got tired with the need to rewrite and go back and forth and change this character. So I took an online course from, you may have seen it advertised on Facebook. James Patterson had this deal where you could spend $90 and he would tell you everything he knew about writing. And I was prepared to be cynical, but actually he has a very good way of working on what's sort of an outline. He writes scenes. He writes a sentence or two about each scene in order, and he can play with it and play with it for months if he needs to until he's got the story boarded out that way. And I decided to try that with the French book. And I think it worked really well. I didn't do it so much with the first book because the first book really poured out of me, because I love David and Alice so much and I love their experience. But for the second book that I'm closing in on now, I did that. And I think I didn't do it perfectly. I don't have as much experience as he had, but I do think that instead of writing an outline, you know, Sheldon Siegel has shared with us in his classes the outlines that he writes, and they're so detailed and thorough, but I could never do that. He's a lawyer.
Right.
And he's much more logical than I am, you know. So
it's interesting to me that there are those who do that. That there are some authors who really it's almost a page by page outline, and I'm thinking, geez, just write the book instead, you know. Instead of doing the outline, but because there may be a case where there's a lot of research involved, And so, you know, then you've got research that you're writing because you don't use all your research, but you've also got this massively heavy, heavy outline. I wonder if after a while an outline is necessary when a writer gets comfortable with writing. Do you think it will always be necessary to do that little exercise that you do?
No, I don't. But I do think you. Most writers know where the tricky parts come for them. A lot of us talk about the muddle in the middle, because you get started and you're raving along and it's just great, and then you know where the ending is, but then you've got this nasty piece in the middle where you've got all the clues that are out there, all the characters are out there, but how are you going to get from there to the end without playing tricks on the reader? Because those of us who write mysteries, at any rate, that particular part of the genre, know that we have to play fair, so we can't just produce magic endings.
It's out of thin air. Yes, I understand. Right. It used to drive me crazy when I'd read those books. I'm so glad that you recognize that that's an issue, because I can, you know, I want to read a good mystery. I don't want to figure it out, but if the at the end of the question of who done it is a character that I've not seen on the landscape, that really ticks me off.
I know.
It's just not fair. I feel like I've lost out. You know, I'd rather it be someone who's mentioned and who, you know, my own deductive logic can kind of put him in the mix or something.
That's
Yeah.
Someone who's in the background, like a real suspect might be, but who you could figure out had something more to say. One of the things that I am not crazy about that some other writers do is something like this. So he knew he had to meet with Sergeant Smith. So he meets with Sergeant Smith, and after that, he knows what he has to do. Well, I want to know what Sergeant Smith said, because I feel like that's a withhold, and I just don't care for those. I feel a little manipulated when that happens. But some good writers do them, and they keep me in the story through character and other ways, but it's not my favorite.
Yeah. I want to have layers in a story that I'm reading, regardless, because I read cross genres. So I need to have a lot of different layers. I want red herrings in the story. It should not be a straight line between A to Z. There should be, there's all those other letters there for a reason. So make it interesting.
And there are a lot of them.
Yeah, there really are. And the fact of the matter is, though, that, you know, I want to, at the end of a chapter, go, wow, I just didn't expect that. And, oh, my God, are you kidding me? And, you know, there are some books, I mean, there's a book that I read not too long ago. It's actually a romance book that I read three times in, say, 4 weeks. I read it three times. It was so well written that I read it. It very rarely happens, but there are some books that are so good, I read them over and over and over again. And some I read out loud, too.
Oh, that's interesting.
You don't reread books?
I don't read books out loud. I haven't done that since I was reading to my grandkids when they were a little younger, except for my own books, because that was a tip that I picked up from somebody, which is before you turn that book in, read it out loud, and you'll hear all kinds of peculiar things. Yeah.
Oh, you really do. I was having a conversation with Professor David Morrell, who, you know, is the co-founder of International Thriller Writers, and he's so wonderful. I always learn something new when he comes on my show, and I try to get him on as often as possible. But he said, you know, he reads his stuff out loud, and I think it's a mistake if authors don't do that, simply because the dialogue may be stilted. If it's a man writing in a woman's voice, I want them to hear it and say, is this really what
that's
a woman
right.
would say or ask, and vice versa. And, you know, if somebody's a bad guy, are they going to be talking, you know, quite eloquently? I'm not sure. So for me, the reason I like to read out loud, like, I love Pat Conroy out loud. I'll read anything that he writes out loud. I'm so sad that he's gone now and won't be writing anymore. But The prose is so beautiful, and it really engages a different sense when you're listening to it versus but I don't have the patience to listen to an audiobook. My mind will wander, so I can't do audiobooks. I know it's a strange thing, but because it becomes ambient noise to me, just it's white noise to me after a while, and you know my mind will wander. So yeah, so I have to read it, but I do like reading out loud, not the whole book, but there are some passages to me that are so well written. Susan, I have to tell you, there are so many good writers, yourself included, because I've read a couple of your books already. I have one more to read before I catch up.
Thank you.
There are so many good books out there right now, and it's like an embarrassment of riches.
Mm-hmm.
So I love, that's why I like talking to authors, because there's so many there's so much good stuff out there.
Well, how do you feel about humor in mystery books? Because I don't write funny like Janet Evanovich does. I'm not trying to write jokes.
Right.
And I'm actually, most of the humor in my Danny, all of the humor in my Danny books are virtually, except for Dickie, her ex-husband, but most of it is in Danny's head. And because you were an ED, you probably know this the same way I know it. There are times when you're sitting in a meeting or talking to someone who's really annoying you, and you have a cynical internal dialogue with yourself going on, but you can't say it. I mean, you know, if you're talking to someone, you're asking him for $1 million, you can't very well say what you're thinking when you think he's being very pompous and self-important. But so a lot of that I wound up, without having intended to, incorporating into the character of Danny. And I've gotten a lot of critical support for that humor. A lot of the people reviewing the books have said it's very witty, it's very funny, but it's not funny. Ha ha. I couldn't write a joke type thing if my life depended on it.
Right. Well, I think that's true. What you're saying is right, because it's the irony, you know, gallows humor, or because it becomes very authentic then. And, you know, if it's something you're going to say, it's something your character is going to say. So I think I have read books where every time a character says or do something, there's an italicized thought process going on, and it just drives me crazy throughout the whole book. I want to say, don't talk down to your reader. You know, we understand why the character said what they said and why they're doing what they're doing. You don't have to explain it in a like a thought cloud to us. I think humor's fine. I mean, you know, most everybody has some kind of a sense of humor. It doesn't take me out of the story. Sarcasm and things like that. I think it's important. All of those things are important when you're creating character, don't you think?
I do. I was thinking about capers because you said you like them, and I do too. And frequently, not always, but frequently there's humor in them because, of course, things go wrong in capers. That's what makes the story. And I remember Donald Westlake. Remember his Dortmuller series?
Of course.
I loved those. This is one of the first times I read crime that had humor in it that felt to me just right for the story.
Yes. Well, you know, it's funny that you mentioned him. I think the past 10 authors I've spoken to have been mentioning Donald Westlake. That has such an impression that he's made on everyone. I know, isn't that interesting? I'm going to ask you a few quick questions for a few quick answers because we're fast running out of time here. And I wish that I had more time to speak to you, and you're going to have to come back. So,
thank you.
The other night I did something on Saturday night as a thank you to authors because I'm so thankful that people actually really want to talk to me. And so I had an open mic, and I just had everyone call in. Anyone who wanted to could call in and talk about their books and the genre that they wrote in and where they were on the internet. So I'm first going to ask you to tell everyone where we can find you on the web. That's real important information for everyone, and in social media.
Well, I have a website, www.susancshea.com, And I will be debuting a new website that will be focused more on the French books, and that will be the same URL, SusanCShade.com. So that's one place. I'm on Facebook. I'm going to start an author page right now. I just have a personal page, and I'm on Twitter. And I have some Pinterest pages, some albums, and I have started one for the first French book for the story that's set in Burgundy. And I have some for the Danny books. So I'm around online. People can look me up. I'm always glad.
And you answer your own Facebook stuff. I know you do. You're very good about that. You do not have someone doing it for you.
Oh, no,
no. So that's lovely. So so usually at the end of my conversation with someone, we do five quick questions and five quick answers. So I had some questions that I asked the other night on Saturday evening. I only asked one question, one writing question of each author. So here I'm going to just use a couple of those for you, if that's okay
with
you.
All right.
Okay. So who would you like to be compared to? What author would you like to be compared to?
Well, I'm going to be really honest, and it's going to sound egotistical, and I know I'm nothing like her, but Jane Austen.
It doesn't sound egotistical. It sounds wonderful, and I understand where you're coming from. I understand why you're saying that. Mm-hmm. It's the humor aspect of it, too, and I like that, and it's really nice. Very good.
And it's
good
intimate.
You.
She talks about small communities and about ordinary people trying to get along in the world. I love her work, and she's my ideal.
How wonderful. I love that answer. Whose book are you reading right now?
Well, I'm reading a couple of books right now. One of them is by Tony Broadbent. He's a Bay Area writer, and he has written three books, all of which have the smoke in the title, the smoke being London. That's a slang term for London. And I'm reading the third one, which is called Shadows in the Smoke. So that's Tony Broadbent. I'm also reading some of the stories that make up the Grandchester Mysteries, on PBS, the man, and I'm stuck for his name right now, and the book isn't in front of me, the man who wrote the stories also is a TV writer and producer, so he knew what he was doing when he started them, but they're little novellas, there are half a dozen in each volume, and maybe because I've seen the TV show, I'm enjoying them because I can put flesh on the characters very easily, but they're clever little mysteries. They're not always murders, and they're fun.
Oh, how fun. You've obviously traveled. Is there a place on your bucket list that you'd like to go?
Turkey. Tim and I wanted to go to Turkey. We never got there, and now the political situation is such I'm not sure. But I have a friend who taught science there, an American. Well, she's not American. She's Swiss-French. But she taught science there for a year in Istanbul, and she doesn't think it's that unsafe. So if I get up my nerve, I think I would go to Turkey because I love everything about the culture and the food and the art,
oh,
of course.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah, but I've been to Bali and Hong Kong and France, of course, a lot of places, but I haven't traveled as much as some of my friends who really travel, I think, more adventurously than I do.
Do you think you will travel in your character's footsteps when you go to France and if you go to Turkey?
Oh, absolutely. And not only that, but the trip that I'm doing to France now is specifically designed so that I can find out what in this small provincial city in France, in Burgundy, are the delectables and the special holiday treats that they have, because I know they have special candies and meats and cheeses and dishes and all kinds of things, what they use for their cadeau, their presents. So I am going to absolutely gather all the information I can to enrich the books, because I know that my books are going to be popular with, the French books are going to be popular with Francophiles. So I want to make sure I've got lots of delectable details.
It sounds yummy. And, you know, I'm sorry you're going on such a treacherous research trip. That sounds like a lot of fun, though.
As my friends say, someone has to do it.
Has to do it, absolutely. I asked this the other night, and it was kind of interesting, the answers I got. But so let me ask you, if you won the lottery, would you still write and care if your books sold, or would you give your books away?
If I won the lottery, I would absolutely keep writing. I would care very much that my books, that my agent still wanted to rep me and that the publisher still wanted to publish me. And they wouldn't give away the books. I could, you know, but there's another question embedded in your question, and that, I think, is do you make or do you hope to make a living selling books? And I'll be honest with you, I don't make what I would consider to be even a decent living. It's hard in this world to sell enough books to
yes,
do that,
it is.
And I'm not yet, I hope I will be, but I'm not yet so popular and so successful that I get royalties, but I don't get big royalties. So I would love to be in a position where I made enough money to feel that I was accepted, that my writing was, you know, the people
sure.
wanted to read it. But if I could, I'd buy 1,000 books and give them away. Sure. I mean, you know, why not?
Interesting. Good for you. Good for you. Susan C. Shea, it has been such a pleasure to speak with you. And it's been fun. I wish I had more time, because you're so interesting, and I can see that there are a lot of things to explore with you. You have an interesting life, and I'd like to know more about it. So maybe one day you'll come back when your French series is out, and we can talk about that too.
Great. I would love it. It's a pleasure to talk with you. We talk a little bit at the conventions, but you're always surrounded by people, and we never get a chance to sit down. So this was a lot of fun. I enjoyed it. Thank you for inviting me, Pam.
Oh, it's my pleasure. When I'm in the company of writers, it would be like someone who goes to Hollywood to meet stars. Writers are my celebrities, and I feel so honored to know writers such as yourself. It's a thrill for me. I'm truly a fangirl. So thank you so much for being here. And if
thank
we don't
you.
Bump into each other at another conference, we will talk again, okay?
Great. Well, I'll be at Malice, so if the Malice Domestic. So if you're there, we'll check in.
I'm not going to Malice this year. But I want to go out to some West Coast stuff, but there's a lot of really good ones happening on the East Coast here, because I'm in Southwest
mm-hmm.
Florida. So we'll see what happens. I don't know.
Okay.
You never know. I'm keeping the door open to anything, right? Thank
okay,
you
well,
so
I'll
much.
See you on Facebook then.
You sure will. Thank you, Susan Shea, for being with me tonight. Good night, Susan.
Thanks a lot, Pam. Bye-bye.
Sure thing. Bye. And, folks, that's our show for tonight. Remember Revis Wortham on Friday. I can't wait for that. He comes and says his old-timey expressions. It's going to be tons of fun. Thank you for being with me. Go pick up one of Susan's books. And thank you, Mom and Dad. Good night.